But the one thing I will do, me being a Midwestern boy and you being a Southern boy and now being in the South, I'm going to give everybody the Southern greeting. Howdy. Okay.
Hi, y'all. I'll translate.
Hi, y'all. There you go. Okay, so how did we end up where we are with the dog as a human companion? Start with a little history lesson. The genus Canis, which includes the wolves, the coyotes, the jackals, and some others, is old. Somewhere around 9 million years ago, the dog and the cat started to separate from one another and became the Canidae family and the Felidae family. And then 2 million years ago, the dog and coyote lineage just separated, and I think that's probably one of the critical separations. 300,000 to 130,000 years ago, the wolf lineages became modern wolves. And then modern dog lineages are actually 100,000 years or more old. But if you look at the three spots where I have the asterisks, that's an indication that in all this time, there was continuing genetic exchange among the dog, the wolf, and the coyote, and then even today they can interbreed, although there are sometimes barriers. This is the Rasboinichia canid, which was discovered in the Altai Mountains of Siberia. And I think the most important phrase in this paper is this one. This is evidence of the earliest domestication disrupted by the last glacial maximum. The domestication of the dog is not a linear thing that started then and came now. It was millennia of starts and stops and failures and successes, interruption by climate, interruption by local extinction for disease and other purposes. And this went on over a fairly wide geographic area. So here we are looking at a dog. When you look at the figures don't reproduce very well, but when I look at these closely, this is plainly a dog 33,000 years ago. So if we go back modern dog lineages 100,000 years ago and this incipient or developing domestication 30,000 years ago, 15,000 years ago, for sure we understand that the dog was domesticated. We don't yet know for sure what went on in here, but I suspect it was just a lot of the starts and stops, geographical starting over here and different lines of families of wolves. And we know that we accept that dogs and humans came across the Bering Bridge 14,500 years ago from Siberia to North America. And to that I say, oh really? The problem is the evidence for it is under the Bering Sea. And we're not going to see it anytime soon, okay? But there are some of us now that are beginning to have questions about whether we've got that completely right. And one of the big ones, I didn't put a slide on it, but in South America on the West Coast, archaeological scientists have discovered a culture from at least one site that appears completely different from all of the other cultures up and down the South American West Coast and the North American West Coast. So we know the people that came across the Bering Bridge did this, you know, up and down with the Pacific Ocean in boats, but we don't know if we've got the whole story right, and we have some animal reasons for thinking that too. So here we are 15,000 years later looking at the four oldest sites in North America of Native American hunter-gatherer groups and the dogs that were with them. Actually, these have been revised again by new dating. The two 9,000s are probably about 10,200. This is probably 8,300, and this is probably about 8,000 years ago, a long time ago. Where are they? This is Stillwell, this is Coster, this is Modoc, and this is Roger Shelter. This tells you something about the people. This is the lower valley of the Illinois River. This is the Kaskaskia River system. And this is part of the what is now today the Lake of the Ozarks water system. So it's forest, it's water, its game, its aquatic game, its fruits, vegetables. These people, for being hunter-gatherers, that was a tough life, and they naturally would settle in areas where the pickings would be a little bit easier. Now, what does all that have to do with today? This may be the oldest dog. I've looked at all these dogs. Now, we have them at the Illinois State Museum, and I've looked at the pathology of all the bones. This may be the oldest of the dogs. This was a deliberate burial, and you can see from the length of the trowel that this was a fair-sized dog. It wasn't little, and it wasn't big. What else did we find on this dog? Well, you see this rough stuff here. If you're not familiar, that's an indication of dental disease. Inflammation of the alveolus, which is called periodontitis, or reaction on the bone. Now, we get fragments, and the different color shows us that this fragment came off in the ground. It wasn't why the dog died. But the other thing we see is these teeth are extremely worn. So we don't know how old this dog was when it died. We know that what the people ate, the dogs ate, and of course the dogs were foraging in the people's discard piles and probably catching things on their own, rabbits and so forth too. So one of the things that we see is dental disease in these older specimens is just as frequent and just as severe as it is in the dog today, although we have probably concentrated by breeding. Your veterinarians know that the smaller breeds of dogs are more subject to dental disease than the larger breeds of dogs. So what we humans have done since the Victorian age, when we started messing around with dogs and I think messing the dog system up, what we see is they may have concentrated problems that were already present. We forget that these things occur. Those things occur because they have a genetic capacity to occur, and that turns out to be a really, really important concept. This is the two humerus bones from the same dog. I didn't put a ruler in there. This dog was probably about the size of a Jack Russell Terrier, so relatively small, and this was a broken humerus that healed. Now think about that. Today, you take them to the veterinarian and there'd be surgery or there'd be a cast and things would turn out fine. In a hunter-gatherer culture, that's hand-to-mouth. You spend all day, every day, trying to get enough food to feed yourself and your group, which was small. Most of these groups were maybe a dozen or two dozen people at the very, very most. On the average, I'm told that they're probably less than 5 or 10. So somebody had to take care of this dog. It couldn't hunt. It couldn't take care of itself. It couldn't defend itself. We don't know how the care occurred. We don't really know why. The dog may have been a very good sentry and knew when to bark when an enemy was around, but something made this dog very precious to the people around it. This is another one. This is from Roger Shelter over in Missouri. This is probably the worst case of elbow arthritis. This is the top of the ulna bone. Probably the worst case of elbow arthritis that I ever saw. And I've done a lot of pathology work in my career, although I'm not a pathologist. The same thing applies. It takes a long time for this to get this bad. Somebody had to take care of that dog while all that was going on. Protect it, defend it, feed it, okay? What was the motivation for that? Is it the same motivation in our culture or not? We don't know yet. The bottom bone, the top two bones are the ones you just looked at. The bottom bone is not the ulna, it's the foot bone, the metatarsus. Now you can see that this dog from Iowa, the foot bone is almost as big as the humerus bones of the little dog. That's like, you know, this bone of my foot being almost the same length as my humerus. Okay? People talk about Indian dogs being roughly the same size and short hair coat and ears that stand up. There was huge diversity in that population even back then. The amount of diversity is so great that we pretty much understand that the size range of the domestic dog occurs as it does today because it was there before. This is newer. This is about 1,700 years ago, and I just was going to point out, this is the top of the tibia bone, or the knee. So it's here, right? the only thing I'm going to point out here is there's a little rim there that shouldn't be there. That's just a reaction, not from abuse. It's not that serious, probably just from work, from a very active life. We would see that today. This one is about that same time period, 2,000 or so years ago. That probably was an abscess cavity, but it could have been from a wound. Did it kill the dog? I don't know. But the teeth, you can see the teeth were glued back in. Archaeologists do that, and I keep telling them, don't do that because we can't see the alveolus, and that's a lot of times where the disease is. But okay, they do it anyway. So I suspect that what happened was that these teeth were found near the mandible, and so the archaeologists knew which teeth went with which individual. Well, that's fine, but it tells us something that we can work with, and that is that the dog probably died relatively proximate to whatever caused this. Now, maybe it got septic. Maybe this was one of several injuries. You know, we get fragments, and we don't really get whole skeletons very much of the time. So we see these kinds of things today. This is just arthritis around the head of a humerus, where the articulation is, up here in my shoulder, where I've got a couple of screws. The arthritis at this stage, at this degree of severity, takes a while to develop. This dog would have been lame at this point. This is pretty severe, okay? Somebody had to watch after this dog because this existed for a long while. There's two things to see here. This is the lower end of the femur, so it's here, okay? The first is that there is a subtle little line here, which is the same thing that I showed you earlier, a subtle indication of an active life. Okay, it's not an abuse, it's just an active life. But notice how nice and cleanly this is cut off and smooth. Hold that thought, we'll come back to it. This is my very favorite slide. This is from some place called the Kuhlman Habitation, which is about 900 years ago. This was in the Illinois River Valley, this site is, and this was during the Mississippian period that we all, you know, Cahokia Mounds, and, you know, we all know about the Mississippian culture. That went from about 950 AD to about 1550 or close to 1600 before contact with Europeans. There is no dog here. There's no bones. This is the shadow in the rock of where this dog was. And it was a deliberate burial. It was buried with some kind of an object here. And you can see again from the trowel, sort of a moderate, small to moderate sized dog. But this was buried with it. This is just a napkin that the archaeologist stuck in there to keep the outer bowl from falling in on the inner bowl. This dog was buried with things intended for it to have in an afterlife. So this was a dog that was, for some reason, the subject of a lot of reverence. So I'm often asked, did people eat dogs? Well, there's a couple things you look for, and this is an example of how you can get led astray. The original archaeologists that identified this put an arrow right here on what looks like it could have been a knife cut. The problem is, probably after the bone dried a while after coming up out of the ground, that it goes up all the way to the top here, and all it is a crack. So you've got to be careful when you're trying to diagnose things. But look at this. Okay, these are singe marks from a fire. And people assume, oh yeah, they must have roasted it and eat it. No, the dog could have died, and its remains just ended up on the trash pile, which was usually some distance from a hunter-gatherer's camp, because they knew it would attract rats, raccoons, other dogs, and so they wanted that away from where they were living, and embers from a fire would get thrown there too. So probably all that happened is that got singed in the campfire that was associated with the trash pile. Now, I showed you that femur before that was cut nice and cleanly. You see we've got two nice lines right here, and then it looks like it broke. Somebody was working this dog bone to make something out of it. And I've seen examples of this. What they did, they would take a long bone, a femur or a radius or a humerus, and cut it in sections, inch and a half to 2 inch long, make sure it's hollowed out, and string it and now it's an ornamental necklace. Is that because carrying something of that dog with them might have been considered to be a transfer of some kind of power or skill? You know, maybe this dog was a good hunter. We don't know. Maybe it was just a question of reverence for some other reason. Sometimes it's ceremonial. We don't always know the cause, but again, we know that 10,000 years ago, people that had to forage for a living cared very much about the dogs that were around them. Let's skip that. So when we go back to look in deep time, one of the things we need to understand is because of the hand-to-mouth lifestyle and the amount of other work that had to be done, a deliberate burial indicates very high regard. Now, in regards to the human-animal bond, that's easy to see. We've seen some evidence of it here. It's a lot more difficult to interpret because we don't know the whys. It might have been that this was a very, very adept working animal, a very good protector, a very good hunter, a guard dog. Sometimes they're ceremonial. And, of course, we don't know what the nature of the emotion was. And even in those times, cultures of the Southeast were quite different from the cultures of the Midwest. And so we don't know what those cultural implications are. We know that there is a bond there. And that's what we're working towards now, is to try to understand more about that bond. But the thing is, humans were diverse and dogs were diverse at that time. So were the wolves that the dogs came from. The wolves were not of uniform size. They were not of uniform geography. Dog domestications probably were a fit and start and fail kind of thing over a very wide portion of Eurasia, down into Southeast Asia, what we now know as Vietnam, and in Japan. So we know that these changes occurred over a wide area and over a very long period of time. Okay, what has that got to do with anything? Well, let's think about doggy diversity. I was part of both of these studies, so I've stayed familiar with them. In a study of 463 Portuguese water dogs and 526 other dogs, we did find that the single gene IGF-1 explains 50% of the size difference and also explains relationships to some diseases. We tend to see hip dysplasia in large dogs, patellar luxation in small dogs, and that correlated to this IGF-1 activity. In other words, the capacity for those size differences to occur already existed before people start messing around with them in the Victorian period. Okay, so we know that the dogs came from the gray wolf over multiple localities over a long period of time. We know that there were probably a lot of successes and failures among various human cultures and various morphotypes of the dogs, various size. But it all started with pre-existing genetic capacity for diversity, and that's what became the fuel for the Victorian age that got us where we are now. So sometimes we point fingers at breeders for exacerbating certain traits that are negative, and sometimes they deserve it, but they didn't create the problem. In most cases, even with things like hip dysplasia, it was already there. Okay, so that's the message for today, and at some future time, we could certainly sit down again and go into a great deal of detail about some of this. So thank you.